Cornish Language Fellowship. Chris is a founding member of the Celtic Council of Australia Steering Committee, an associate of the Institute of Cornish Studies, an associate of Sydney University's Foundation for Celtic Studies, and having deep roots from the 1860s in the Cornish mining areas of Australia's Little Cornwall, he'll be sharing about some of the Cornish experiences in Australia.
Following on what Virginia mentioned, my ancestors were assisted migrants, but they paid £5 and they weren't assisted by Her Majesty's prisoners.
They were assisted by Her Majesty's prisoners.
To begin with this map, I'll just show you roughly the area we're covering. Although my ancestors mainly went to Cornish mining areas in South Australia, and Australia, I'm not covering those at all. Because if you come to Australia in the next couple of years, there are a number of festivals on and gatherings that you can hear all about that. I'm going to talk about something a little bit different. So the area we're going to look at is basically from Tasmania, which is right down here, Van Diemen's Land, as Philip mentioned, up to Queensland along the Pacific coast. You can see there's a lot over here as well, most of it's empty. Talk will cover very briefly some Cornish experiences in the first century of settlement, stretching 2,250 miles along a coast that spans from cool climate Hobart to tropical Cairns, and in truth we'll look a bit inland as well. It'll be interesting to hear how these few experiences differ from or mirror those of Cornish immigrants to North America or elsewhere around the world. Nearly half a century before serious European settlement, then recognised Cornish heartland colonies of South Australia and Victoria and the huge mining areas, Cornish people walked the new land, starting from day one, 221 years ago, on January 26, 1788, in Sydney Cove. Sailors, marines, and even a few convicts from Cornwall. Having sailed 12,700 sea miles, across the Indian Ocean, from southern Africa and then the Southern Ocean, between Australia and Antarctica, they arrived 8 months after leaving Portsmouth. If we do not count Cornish sailors who are undoubtedly among the crews of earlier English explorers, particularly Captain Cook's Endeavour, these few who came with our first British governor, Arthur Phillip, on the first fleet for the start of the Cornish presence in Australia. James Bruce, born near Lanson in Cornwall in 1759, was a rare but not unknown type of Cornish settler, the convict. Granted land to farm, he had almost single-handedly shown the way from starvation for the colony through agriculture on lands well away from the sandstone and sandy coastal fringe. Bruce goes down in history as the first farmer and husbandman, despite dying poor in 1837. In 1782, he was tried at Bodmin Assizes and sentenced to death for burglariously breaking and entering the dwelling house of Thomas Olive and stealing thereout two silver watches, value £5. He was reprieved and sentenced to transportation for 7 years. He was sent on the Scarborough, one of the first fleet, and arrived in New South Wales in January 1788. Like the other first fleet convicts, Bruce would have worked at first under the direction of Governor Phillip and his subordinates in establishing the rudiments of a new colony in Sydney Cove. But as supplies in the first fleet had brought with them dwindled, it became vital that the colony learned to grow its own food. In November, Phillip selected Bruce to go to Parramatta, then called Rose Hill, west of Sydney Town, to try his hand at farming. Phillip allocated Bruce 1.5 acres of already cleared ground, assisted in clearing a further 5 acres. He was given 2 sows and 6 hens, and was to be fed and clothed from the public store for 15 months. In return, if he was successful, he was to be granted 30 acres. After 15 months, Bruce announced that he and his wife, Elizabeth, whom he married in 1790, were now self-sufficient in food, and their farm formed the nucleus of a small community of farmers who, while technically still convicts, enjoyed considerable freedom and later had other convicts assigned to work for them. After Bruce's sentence expired in 1792, the title of his land was deemed to him the first land grant in the colony. Bruce moved further out to the Hawkesbury River, which was quite a large river in our terms, unfortunately floods. So his farming was taken out by flood after a couple of years, and he moved further to the south around Campbelltown, where he was employed as an overseer by a landowner. He died at Campbelltown in September 1837. His gravestone, which he carved himself, reads, "Sacred to the memory of James Bruce, who departed this life September 5 in the year of our Lord, 1837, native of Cornwall, and arrived in this colony by the forced fleet, age 77. My mother reared me tenderly, with me she took much pains, and when I arrived in this colony, I sowed the first grains, and now with my heavenly Father, I hope forever to remain." The memory of James Bruce is perpetuated in the naming of a number of key locations in Sydney. Several early British governors had Cornish connections, including the notorious William Bligh, mentioned that a couple of times. His ill-considered approach to governing a fledgling colony ended in the famous Rome Rebellion, which brought to an end the basic penal settlement era of New South Wales. Following Bligh, a Scot, Lachlan Macquarie, came in to build a colony. And one of the driving forces of the burgeoning sheep and fine wool industry in Australia in that period was John MacArthur's wife, Elizabeth MacArthur, née Veal, born on the Devon Cornwall border from a Cornish Veal family. It is a competency, independence and vision of such people of Cornish stock as James and Elizabeth, and people of all levels of society that anchored the fledgling colony of New South Wales and made it inevitable the building of a nation would one day occur. A long way south in Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania, Bass and Flinders in 1798 took a very small boat, basically just a dinghy, sailed down the east coast from Sydney Town, discovered Van Diemen's Land was an island. They also discovered the same anchorage to the north of that island, which was named by Governor Hunter, Port Dalrymple, in the south of that island. The capital Hobart was founded in 1803 by Lieutenant John Bowen, sent by Governor Philip Gidley King. King was born in 1758 in Lanson, Cornwall. So it was little to wonder that when Yorktown started in the north in 1804, it was renamed Lanson, or now called in Australia Launceston. The river on which it stands, the Tamar, and the administrative subdivision of Cornwall. In 1856, self-government came to the island, which was renamed Tasmania, after explorer Abel Tasman. Tasmania was to become a place firstly for Cornish farmers to make a new life, but later miners flocked to the tin mines of the Central Plateau. Back to New South Wales, after 25 years, the colony had been kept to the coastal fringe, and this led to regular famine because we couldn't support the population. A way was found in 1813 over the rugged Blue Mountain barrier. Rugged not because of the height, but because of the geology in terms of very sheer cliffs. It led quickly in 1817 to the establishment of the town of Bathurst on the Macquarie River. The economic conditions in Cornwall in the 1820s produced agricultural distress. It is little wonder then that William John Tom Sr., his wife Anne, daughter Mary, son John and James left Cornwall in 1823 for Sydney Town. Near the end of the voyage, Anne bore another son, William Tom Jr. Hardy people that they were, they walked across the Blue Mountains to the west looking for land to get a grant. No covered wagons, but if they were lucky, a lumbering bullock dray to walk beside. For many years, settlement was banned west of the Macquarie River, but when the ban was lifted, the land was released for selection. In 1829, a small group of Cornish farmers were among the first to settle at a place that in a relatively well-watered valley. Tom took advantage of that decision, and some of them in the Cornish settlement area. We had the company of other Cornishmen, George Hawke, John Glasson, others of the surnames Lane, Grenville, Pierce, Thomas, Oates, and Paul. Among the settlers was George Hawke, who was born in St. Edmund Parish in Cornwall in 1802. After periods of wool slavery, he immigrated to Australia, left Plymouth in 1828 and arrived end of that year. After arriving in Sydney, his journey took him to the residence of William Tom at Cornish Settlement, where he slept the night and then went to stay with William Lane nearby. He did well, and he soon thought he had the prospect of supporting a wife, and cast his mind back to his cousin Jane. John Glasson advised him to go to Cornwall after writing to her of his intentions. She, being a very intelligent Cornish woman, agreed. Wisely imposing a limit of 2 years. The ship went first to New Zealand, went on the rocks, and finally he made it to Plymouth on the 8th of October, 1834, well over a year since he started. It's no wonder then that George cleared customs quickly and hurried to Vidruthen and St. Colum to find that Jane was his father's house. They were married there in March 1835 and then departed for Sydney on a Florentine in April. Having a very pleasant trip this time, arriving on the 4th of August, George observed that there were bushfires burning, and he knew that this meant drought was on the land, and this condition lasted until May 1839, 4 years, not unlike our present situation. For our people now, our deeply seared knowledge of Australia, we know the meaning of 4 or 5 years of drought, but what a contrast to Jane from the green hills, fields of Cornwall. Before going to Cornwall, George Hawke was convinced that agriculture was going to have a future in the Western District. From his observation of the country, its soil and the location of their Cornish settlement, despite losing thousands of cuttings and plants of hawthorn and fruit trees that he had brought with him, eventually he planted out hawthorn as fencing, and a lot of that still survives around the central plainlands of New South Wales. He brought in 20 apple trees, having 1 year's growth plus a lot of apple, cherry and plum suckers. This foresight, sort of foresight, saw the Blue Mountains, Western Slopes, with beautiful apple and cherry orchards and peaches, apricots and other fruit to this day. Wonderful legacy. Underlying all their community activities was their firm religious faith, based on strict Wesleyan Methodist principles, encouraged by the work of William Tom, who came to be known as Pastor William Tom, and their local lay preacher. His first services were held on a rock outcrop at the top of a ridge overlooking the valley, known as Bethel Rock. Tom then held services of worship in his house once it was completed. And until a small Wesleyan chapel was constructed and opened in 1842, the first was the Baptist, and that site can be seen today. The present day chapel was erected in 1872, designed by a Cornish architect from Penzance, and dedicated in 1873. George Hawke and his descendants are buried in Bing Church Cemetery, as it became known, and indeed descendants still live in the beautiful restored house of Pendarvis of Buchanan. Many other descendants of the valley's early settlers are buried there or are scattered around New South Wales, including members of our own association. The roads are still lined with hawthorn. The Cornish settlement in the valley of Bing retains its Cornish memory to this day, some 180 plus years later. It wasn't all farming though. In 1849, a couple was discovered near Sheep Station Creek, and John Glasson and Richard Lane employed a mine captain, and working was commenced. The Cornish settlement became connected to a small scale copper mining and smelting in the valley at nearby Karangarra for around 50 years. Reverting to purely pastoral lands after the 1930s. It had been surveyed as a town in 1891 and renamed Bing, but the town never prospered, and there's only evidence of the roads today. There are only the farmsteads and the chapel, and today people are moving in on acreages. The copper mining boom of the 1840s drew many more people, including those directly from Cornwall, into the Western District. To Cornish settlement, as we've heard, but also to the west and south. In 1851, There was a meeting in William Thomas' home between a number of people, Edmund Hammond Hargraves, John Hardman Australista, and the sons of William Tom. Hargraves had brought with him a canning dish and cradle and tried to show them how to use it, and took them out north of 27 to Prospect. They came back having not been able to find anything. Hargraves continued to show them how to use the cradle and took his leave and set out for other places. A little later, the Tom sons and Mr. set out again, and this time they actually found gold 11 miles from their home. William Tom Senior was going to Sydney and he took the 4 ounces of gold and handed it to Mr. Hargraves. William Jr. and James Tom did not further hear from Mr. Hargraves. They wrote again, but no reply came. A paragraph then appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald, our paper, in May 1851, stating that Hargraves had found the first payable gold in Australia at Ophir, near Orange. The two Tom men enlisted were said to be Hargraves' associates. After many years of disappointment at the lack of recognition for their find, a select committee of the New South Wales Legislative Assembly was appointed in August 1891 with power to send the persons and papers and inquire into the claims, if any, of William Tom, James Tom and J.H.O. Lister for remuneration as the first discoverers of gold in Australia. The select committee submitted the report on the 2nd of September 1891, and the report identified that these Cornish settlers and Mr. Lister had indeed been the discoverers of gold. And Mr. Hargraves, where it says, Mr. Hargraves, from his recent visit to the Californian gold fields, enabled him to search for gold, but we are satisfied that Mrs. Tom and Mr. were undoubtedly the first discoverers of gold obtained in Australia in payable quantity. So there's a tangible connection between California and Australia and New South Wales. It's not quite a happy one at our end. Another 27 west of Bathurst arrival in was Arcadia, massive load of copper, then with gold and other metals to the south of Mount Knowles in the Orange District was found at Kedgeron Creek. Little remains today except the restored Cornish Engine House, or the White Engine House as it's called, and the graves of mine captain Josiah Holman, who came from Wenner, and those of many miners and families. With renewal of mining operations by Newcrest Mining in the 1990s, huge overcut mine was necessary to move all the buried casks to a new site on the ridge above the White Engine House. Copper at the inland mining centre of Cobar was found in 1870 and identified by Mrs. Sybil Kruger, a Cornish bar maiden. Come and ask you later if you want to know what that means. Well, Cobar is a very isolated place, hundreds and hundreds of miles out in very, very dry country. Miners themselves came, flocked to the area, travelling hundreds of miles over a very desolate country. Another fine discovery, gold Ophir, new areas opened up in the Quartz Belt. The hill and the Tambarura goldfields, the north of Cornish settlement, attracted local inland of Cornish. John Tom, the oldest son of Pastor Tom from Bing, was first president of the Tambarura Association of Alluvial Miners, or I think he called Placer Miner. His brother James found alluvial gold in the Huron River at the junction of Oakey Creek. Further south in Adelong, in New South Wales, the foothills of the Snowy Mountains, in 1875, Cornish born made up 13% of the population where they were searching for gold. Within 25 years, the population had fallen to 1% Cornish. So we heard here that the Cornish moved on, and certainly that was the case in Australia. But where they moved to the Kyandra goldfields, right up in the Snowy Mountains, and quite conditions where in winter it's a bit like here, and also eventually down to the coast, where they started to take up pastoral lands and also other farming activities, dairy and so on. To the north of New South Wales, in the Emmerdale-Torrington area, they found tin. Not an alluvial tin, but they were able to find tin that could be dug into some depth. And Cornish flocked to this area. which is just north of Flanders, where we have a Celtic festival these days, and the Cornish are recognised as part of the Celtic festivals, earlier settlers of that area. Again, going south, down to Victoria, the colony, in 1854, in Newham, announced by Luggett, six of the crew, being members and relations of the Kalanak family of Newham, set sail for Australia. Times were hard, and the seven clergymen, all related by blood and marriage, and shareholders in the Bocas and Skull district, made the decision to try their luck at the Australian Gold Rush over a pine in the Star Inn. It was suggested the mystery would be solved to cover the passage, but Captain Nichols, being a Cornishman, said, and with a couple on his belt, "I'll take you in the district." 11,870 sea miles later, they arrived in Victoria, an absolutely magnificent fleet in a small wagon. Some of the crew stayed in Australia, some returned to Cornwall. A little vessel remained in Australian waters and was wrecked off Rockhampton, Queensland in 1959. In 2008, the sea adventurer Peter Goss had built a modern version, The Spirit of Mystery, launched in June last year, and he and his crew set sail for Australia, arriving on the 9th of March into Port Phillip Bay near Melbourne. Even with modern navigational aids and communications, it was quite a journey. So how much more amazing was the original? To the north of New South Wales on the Pacific coast, the colony of Queensland is one that I've not researched a lot. I mentioned only briefly. A major clutch at Gympie, 130 kilometres north of Brisbane, eased the new colony's economic problems in 1868. Everyone was attracted by the excitement surrounding Queensland's major gold discoveries in the 1870s, Queensland's golden era. Gold was even used to promote settlement in certain areas. To encourage settlement in the Townsville region, business offered a reward of £1,000 to the person who found gold within the area. A station manager found gold in the Star River and caused a small rush. Of course, among those who flocked were Cornish. Charters Towers Gold Rush was one of the most important in Queensland's history. Beginning in 1871, it transformed Charters Towers into a mining, business and social centre. The Cornish were a key component of that mining boom. At the height of the Charters Towers Gold Rush in 1873, Queensland's richest alluvial gold deposits were found in the Palmer River in the far north. And the Palmer River, Goldfields, Ross has researched a bit in this area, but were quite a challenge in tropical Queensland, still occupied by Aboriginals and others from the Pacific Islands who would also sometimes participate in cannibalism. So the Chinese tended to suffer more than the Cornish, but it was a very, very, very tough place. The Queensland's richest alluvial gold deposits were found, as I said, in the far north. Clermont, inland from Mackay, was also a key area for the Cornish after discovery gold in the 1860s. So what I've done is just give you a bit of a feel for the sort of settlement that went on in the eastern coast of Australia, the different sort of experiences that people had. They travelled long distances over the sea, they travelled long distances on land. There's records of people living between Queensland and Victoria as easily as we might hear, say, going down to Sacramento. I'm just amazed by the way people moved around in very, very, very harsh conditions, very dry conditions, walking most of the way. Sometimes they were able to take a steam, take a sailing boat and ride a steamer around the coast. But they're hardy people, and certainly they contributed magnificently to the settlement of Australia. Today we estimate perhaps 2% of Australia's population is of strong Cornish background. That's a bit less than 500,000. And certainly they left a great legacy. And so I hope that if any of you are planning to come to Australia sometime in the next few years, have a talk to us about when you should come, because we'll be having a number of functions on, of activities and festivals where you can learn quite a lot more about the Cornish Australia, and particularly in the mining areas, which I've